It is Ryan Seacrest here. People always say it's good to unwind, but that's easier said than done. The exception, Chumba Casino. They actually make it easier done than said, or at least the same. Chumba Casino is an online social casino with hundreds of casino-style games like slots and blackjack. Play for fun. Play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sign up now and collect your free welcome bonus at chumbacasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we are coming to you live from a couple places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Instagram. Maybe you're listening later on the podcast platform of your choice. However you're listening, however you're watching, we are thankful for you.
Did you see what you did there?
Alex, right? That's not our usual intro. I don't know why you
No, but it's Thanksgiving this week on Thursday. And on Thanksgiving...
Familiar.
You go around the table and you ask everybody to support you on Patreon at patreon.com/comicbook. That's what we do in my family.
I mean, you joke, but that's pretty accurate, I think, for most families.
That is true.
Please follow my podcast.
Be like, hey, just throw $2 in. I'll give you back access to my catalog of podcasts.
Pass the mashed potatoes. Click to subscribe. That's what I say.
That's what you do. Have a little clicker. Have a little button hidden in the mashed potatoes so when they put the spoon in.
You want this turkey? You better follow all of my socials, Uncle Dave. Let's do this. You should already be on this.
I'm on Threads now, man. Check me out on Threads.
Yeah, join Blueski, everybody.
Well, we got a... I didn't have a transition.
Schoikler has it. Justin is the one host with a family member supporting the podcast. Shouts. Schoik's got my mom's back at all times.
I mean, I've been pretty lucky in that I still don't think my parents know what we do.
That's the best thing.
Way to hide it. Well, Pete, what about your parents? Your mom dips in every now and again, right?
Yeah, she does. She does.
That's why we can't tell her your secrets. Until tonight.
Dun, dun, dun.
She doesn't know your home address, right?
Pete's secrets. Well, listen, speaking of secrets, we've got two secret guests for you this evening. We publicize them, so it's not actually a secret.
I'd like to take the Pete Secrets quiz.
All right, we're at Loopy Before Thanksgiving, but why don't we bring in our first guest here? She is the writer of The Sex Lives of Superheroes, which is out right now in stores everywhere from Smart Pop. Ladies and gentlemen, Diana McCollum. Diana, welcome.
Hello. Hey.
Thank you. Look at these posters.
I love your nerd wall. Glorious stuff back there.
Yes, if you're listening, Diana behind her has an amazing, amazing fantasy poster and one for Star Wars Episode 4, I believe it is.
Alex never encountered Star Wars before. Clearly. Yeah.
The one time you're not wearing your Star Wars t-shirt.
Mm-hmm. I like to support indie films.
Yes, truth.
Well, let's talk about this book. This is, per the name, delves into the sex lives of superheroes. It is, to get this out of the way, very scientifically based as well as very funny at the same time. It explores these eternal questions that we've always wondered about, from basics of how superheroes have sex to real minutia, like very specific to the hero, to the villain, to the situation. I know this is in the book, but I'd love for you to talk a little bit about where the initial idea for this came from.
The initial idea for Sex Lives of Superheroes, a couple things combined. I would say Mallrats, huge inspiration. Yeah. I mean, it just kind of goes, it almost goes without saying. You know, they, you know, it's the first kind of nerdy movie I ever watched with actual like nerds in it instead of about being a nerdy thing. And they're asking, like, is Reed Richards' penis stretched like the rest of his body? They're asking if the thing has an orange dork. They use the word dork. That's not my word.
Yep. great quote.
Great quote. I know all the Mallrats quotes. So that was a big influence. Also the Larry Niven essay, Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex. And then I used to write for Cracked.com, and we do back in the day, not currently.
The world's combining here.
Yeah. Cracked was very, these are facts and here are jokes about them. So when I came up with Sex Lives of Superheroes, about like answering kind of all these mall rats like questions we've all had all of our lives as nerds, it was like, I really want to write it in that style of like it's science-based. I looked at scientific journals, anatomy books. I talked to doctors, but it's also just jam full of jokes.
Yeah. It's the full gamut. And, you know, I'm glad then the forward you mentioned, Mallrats, and then the kind of like notes part where you kind of cite all your sources in the back is impressive. I mean, the fact that it went from a bit to a ton of work on your part is impressive. The fact that you saw it through is really impressive. Yeah, it's hilarious and very factual. So
bit to book is the dream pipeline.
Yeah.
Anyone can achieve that is the dream.
Yeah, it's hard to call a publisher up and be like, is this funny? Is this anything? And they're like, you know what?
Let's see.
Could you read a couple scientific journals and get back to us? You'd be like, all right, I'll let you know. I'll let you know if the science pans out.
Well, obviously you were doing a lot of research anyway, as Pete called out and as you mentioned, but you did need to talk to doctors and people as well. Was there any point, what was the most ridiculous question you needed to ask somebody, or the most ridiculous reaction you had from a doctor or other expert?
Ooh, the most ridiculous. I talked to two doctors together because I had emailed one of them. He's a fertility doctor. And he was like, my friend also wants to be on the call, who's also a doctor. they were both nerds, which was so great because they understood the comic book aspect already. And I just needed to ask
everybody get in here. I'm talking about superheroes. Hurry.
Honestly, they absolutely loved the thought game of it, of kind of like walking through it. And I think the funniest part was just we talked about Wolverine semen for like 25 minutes about his sperm. Well, because they're fertility doctors, and my question was, this was like the biggest question I couldn't do research on, because my theory was that Wolverine's healing ability is like a genetic mutant power, and your sperm carries your genes. So I'm like, would his sperm not be able to die because it would also have his healing factor? And we decided, yes, it would inherit his healing factor. It wouldn't die. And then we had to go through kind of a tumble of like, well, what does that mean for him? It means he's going to be very engorged with semen is a word I'll use. It means
no wonder he's so mad all the time.
It makes him cranky. It's going to mean that when he has sex with someone of his unprotected sex, they're going to get pregnant every single time because the sperm will just keep going. And so we fell into like a hole of all these things that will happen to Wolverine if his sperm don't die that explain every reason about why he's cranky and mad all the time.
My big takeaway, and I'm curious to hear if you agree or disagree from this book, is superhero sex is bad.
I think a lot of it is, especially if you're a human having sex with a superhero. Yes, almost definitely bad. I think the only times it's not bad is like Daredevil, possibly very good. He's very in tune with what his enhanced senses mean. He knows what you're feeling and what you like as a partner, so I'm like, I would still definitely fuck Daredevil. That'd be great.
Yeah, though there's a lot of emotional
still on
baggage.
My list. Yeah,
you'd probably gonna die. You know, you're probably gonna die after that.
I mean, some things are worth it. He's like,
It's a good way to go.
It's a good way to go. But yeah,
Wait, before we move on from Daredevil, I don't know how regularly you read Daredevil, but literally the last issue, Elektra told him that he was amazing at making love, and it was because he is so in tune with people's emotions.
Yeah, no, I think that absolutely tracks of everything that I researched about people who have either like a sense default or like a sense advantage, that he would be absolutely be great in bed in relationships, and you can tell when your moods shift and everything about it.
Yeah, well, what's also interesting is we were talking about Spider-Man Reign, because the new series of Spider-Man Reign came out, and so we had to relive that nightmare of the radioactive sperm, and that's in the book.
It's reality, Pete. That's reality.
It's reality. This was the most interesting to research myself. So yeah, I think most listeners, if you're in a comic book club, know about Spider-Man Reign. Peter kills Mary Jane with his radioactive semen because it causes cancer. And this is one of the ones where I was like, this is one of the pitch chapters where I was like, I need to find out if semen has radiation. That's a cool idea. And semen is cool, absolutely radioactive if you have been internally contaminated with radiation. It stays radioactive for years and years and years. It is the most radioactive bodily fluid in your body of all the bodily fluids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, more radioactive than the blood was the least radioactive.
They got to change that song.
So we should not be calling him like spider blood, radioactive spider blood. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, spider cum, radioactive spider cum. I mean, I think we could get that rewritten.
I believe that was the Crazy Town song, Come My Spider, Come My Spider. I don't know.
Yeah, that's just right. Always quoting Crazy Town. It's really hard to keep up.
This is a serious question, but I do want to pivot it into one here from Scheuchler in the comments. Superhero sex is bad if you're a human. Wasn't that the pitch for The Boys? You mostly explored Marvel and DC comics, but what do you think about something like that? I don't know if you watch The Boys, if you have any sense of how they treat sex on there in a relatively more realistic way.
I do watch The Boys. I have one chapter about The Deep. So I do have an essay about The Deep. It's actually about how kind of ocean life has sex and what it's going to mean if you want to fuck a dolphin. The dolphin does want to also have sex with you. Dolphins love having sex. So I do have a chapter about The Deep.
A friend of mine fell out of a boat during a Boy Scout trip when he was a kid, and a dolphin tried to have sex with him.
Oh. I absolutely believe it after reading and watching many things about dolphins for this book.
Very sexual.
I can't believe you had that story queued up.
That's not queued up.
You were ready to go with that. She was like, dolphin sex. You're like, oh, I have the story.
And this is an area of my expertise. I'm dropping some scientific knowledge. It's anecdotal, but it's accurate.
I like the backup. I feel very supported.
Thank you. Thank you.
What were we talking about? We're talking about The Boys. I actually didn't. My publisher was even like, The Boys is really popular. Make sure you have a chapter about The Boys. I didn't have a lot to explore though, because the show just like tells you everything.
Oh, it gets
like,
into it.
They do it.
Like, I don't have to theorize what would happen if a tiny man went inside his boyfriend's penis and he blew up. I'm like, it's in there. I don't have to theorize what
they've done the work.
What a superhero orgy would be like, because it's on the show. So the fact that it is a very sexual show was actually way less to explore, because DC and Marvel is so like, we don't really get into the nitty gritty of their sex lives. You can just guess. You can do your own research.
This is another comment that came up here that, again, I want to pivot into a little bit of a question for you. But Tom Radar says, suddenly reminded me of infamous Batman Catwoman oral sex controversy a few years back. Now, the follow-up here is that Zack Snyder, if you remember, put up a picture that he's like, don't know where this fan art came on of them having oral sex on a roof. I feel like a couple of review stacks back talking about Spider-Man and Black Cat having sex on a roof, and how personally I felt like that was gross and dirty and dangerous. You probably don't have a chapter on that. What's your take on it?
Oh, roof sex. I really don't know how dirty a roof gets. I feel like a roof gets rained on more than it gets walked on.
Exactly, clean.
So I actually don't know if a roof is, but it doesn't get clean. Like, you know,
the roof is the cleanest part of a building, then.
I feel like it is not? Unless the water's not like coming out and you just get standing
swampy.
Water.
Swampy
water. Yeah. But I'm also willing to bet the janitor doesn't like go up to the roof very often. But yeah, I mean, I feel like of all the things they do in their lives, a dirty roof is really low priority for superheroes.
Plus, I mean, it's a private place. It's a private place for them. That's where they have all their hot conversations. That's where all the emotions are running hot. Yeah. I'm pro roof sex, Alex.
Yeah, I like it for the privacy. Like, Johnny Storm's definitely going to fly over and be like, hey, Pete, see you. But other
Sick.
Than that, he's going to be rooting nice. For him.
Having spent so much time in this world, and I imagine this did take a good long while to put all of these essays together, how has that changed your relationship with the comics themselves?
It hasn't changed my entire relationship, but it's changed a few characters for me. I know I already talked about Wolverine, but I just can't look at him the same. Just being like, I know your testicles are so engorged right now. I know you're so grumpy. I know. And like, I know every woman you have sex with either will get pregnant or die. Very terrible thing. So individual characters, I think, have changed a little for me. You know, knowing that Reed Richards can stretch his penis like 1,500 feet, which I also found out. And you're just like, I'm not going to look at this guy the same.
I mean, he has to choose to be fair.
He doesn't automatically do that. No, he is not constantly in a state of, hey, look at this. That's fair.
Hey, check this out.
Check this out.
Pete loves this part of the conversation, right, Pete?
Yeah,
this is fun. People are having fun.
Is there something you haven't mentioned that you want incorporated into continuity? Because I do think this is such an an unexplored area. Comics are sort of opening up a little bit toward this more adult ideas, I think. Is there something you're like, get this in there? It's interesting. There's stories here.
Get this in there? There's stories there. I'm just going through them each in my head.
I know. It's hard to keep all this superhero sex in your brain at one time, but
I feel like I mostly want to like petition for more people to feel bad for Supergirl, maybe, because like I kind of did a pivot from Larry Niven's essay, which was about Superman and how he would like probably kill Lois. But like, you know, I think if he's also just really still, it'd be fine. Like, she just does all the work, whatever. But Supergirl is like, she can't be penetrated by a man, like if he's human. Like, it's another Kryptonian she could, but like she has a vagina of steel very much that would not, you know, have a lot of give to it. So I just feel like she has more relationship problems than the comics are willing to really discuss.
Yeah, I feel
that's
like
the series
DC
they
may
release.
Not go there. Maybe not.
Yeah, they we'll probably say. Wouldn't. But it would have to be like a quick, like, she's dating a human and she's like, I don't know how we're going to do this. We need some small amounts of kryptonite, red sun lamps. I don't know.
Wow. Now that this is out, and again, that you have spent so much time in this headspace, is this something that you would want to come back to for a sequel, more Sex Lives of Superheroes, or do you feel like you're ready to kind of move on to the next subject?
I'm not ready to move on. I actually didn't think I had a second book in me, just because I figured I covered everything. I was like, these are all my thoughts about the Sex Lives of Superheroes, but I've been doing press for 3 or 4 weeks now, and people have ideas. So that I didn't predict. So I kind of have learned that there is more to explore even than I thought. I'm fully willing to explore it again or do like an updated version or a full second book if people are interested. Cool. It's very fun to research. And then once you find the answers, it's super fun to put them all in an essay and be like, oh, I can't believe I found an answer to this question. That's insane. Yeah. So I'd be happy to explore a little more. People have asked some things.
Awesome.
Cool. It's great that the questions keep coming. Well, let me just say also, there's a great chapter about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that I think will change, Pete, your perception about your Turtles on the Half Shell.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tough part is you have to kind of read this and then, you know, block out some of it if you want to still be a fan afterwards.
Yeah, you're blurring out the comics where the giant turtle hogs are, right?
Yeah.
Now, exactly. To be fair, the giant turtle hogs are usually inside the shell hidden, even in real turtles.
He'll still block that part. Oh, okay. He just doesn't want to know where it comes from.
Yeah. Okay. I feel like I told you that before, because when I worked at MTV...
All the time, Alex.
You would bring it up a lot.
We called up a turtle scientist to try to find out why turtles didn't have schlongs in the realistic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles trailer.
So, they're called dorks, Alex.
Oh, yeah, dorks. Man.
Come on, use the current terminology.
That's very fresh terminology.
Diana, before we let you go, is there anything else you would like to plug?
This is a big one, but if you like the sound of my voice and my thoughts, I also co-host a podcast called Talk from Superheroes, which is available wherever you get podcasts.
Awesome.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
Well, great. Congratulations on the book. It's fantastic. It's very fun and very informative.
I learned a lot and will continue to apply this knowledge.
Yes, and we're going to bother Pete with it as much as humanly possible. So thank you, Diana. Thanks for coming on. Have a great night.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Later.
All right, there we go. Once again, that was Diana McCallum. The book is called The Sex Lives of Superheroes. It's out in stores everywhere. You can also get it online, of course, at Smart Pop. And hey, there's, you know, discounts coming up for Black Friday and stuff. Shop local. Pick it up.
Yeah.
Get it.
All right. Why don't we move on and bring in one of our favorite recurring guests here on the show. He has a new book coming out, I believe, December 3rd from Flatiron Books called Alter Ego. This is a standalone sequel to Secret Identity, a book we had him on for years ago, I want to say.
A book ago. A book ago,
if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Segura. Alex,
hey, welcome.
Hey.
Great to see you guys. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, put it down a little bit so we can see the
See the books. We want to see the book.
Great plant life behind you.
Yeah.
I wish I could take credit for it. It's not my doing.
Yeah. Alex, so good to see you. Thank you for coming on again. So as mentioned, this is an interesting take on a sequel. It's more of like a sidequel, if anything, to Secret Identity is what I would call it. I just coined
that. I like that. Yeah, that's good terminology. I mean, I just didn't want it to feel like a direct continuation. So you could read Alter Ego, which is a murder mystery set in the modern day of comics, and not have read Secret Identity independently. But if you read them all together and the Lynx graphic novel, you'll get a much more textured story.
Yeah. Cool. Well, why don't you set up what is the concept here? Like you said, it takes place in the modern world of comics. It's not back in the day. It is a mystery, and it's all set around. Mm. Well, I'll stop talking. You go ahead.
Yeah, no. So, Alter Ego is the story of a former comic book artist named Annie Bustamante who has moved on to direct films. She's almost won an Oscar. She's been acclaimed, and she realizes that her latest project has been shelved for tax reasons. So she's kind of between...
Ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, ripped from today's headlines. She's moved back to New York, and she's just hanging out between projects. And she started noodling on this, for fun, comic book project where she's drawing a fan comic, basically, based on this character that pulled her into comics, the legendary Lynx, this obscure 70s superhero that she loved growing up. Unexpectedly, a new company comes out of the woodwork and claims to have the rights to this character, which is kind of laid fallow for decades, and they reach out to Annie and say, we want you to reboot the character. We want you to write and draw it to be part of this big multi-platform movie, TV, animation, video game campaign to revive the quote-unquote Triumph universe. So it seems pretty amazing to Annie, and as she gets deeper and deeper into the gig, she realizes that these people have no passion for these characters. And she starts getting encrypted anonymous messages from someone called Apparition, which, if you know your legendary Lynx lore, is the mentor to the Lynx in the comic series. And this person is basically warning her that the further and further she gets into it, the more dangerous things will get for her. And Annie begins to discover that maybe the story she's been fed about who created the Lynx is far further from the truth than she would like.
So what keeps drawing you back?
yeah.
What keeps drawing you back to the LEU, Lynx Extended Universe?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, somebody called it the Segura Extended Universe, but LEU sounds better. You know, I thought Secret Identity was going to be a standalone. I thought it would just be done. And when I turned it into my editor, he asked, you know, well, what's Carmen, the protagonist, up to now? Like, what can you flash forward and show, you know, kind of put a bow on it and show what she's doing in the modern day? And so I wrote a little epilogue where Carmen, without spoiling too much, she gives an interview basically saying, yes, I did create this character. And that's where Alter Ego springs out of, where we follow that reporter and she's driven off the road because she's got a recording that confirms that Carmen is the creator of the Lynx. So the book, basically, it kind of sprang from that epilogue and the idea of showing the comic book industry today versus the 70s, which doesn't exist anymore. You know, a place where there is no comic industry where you're not thinking about your characters and ownership and media rights and things like that. Whereas in the 70s, you know, you just got the gig and you hope that you would get another gig after that. And you didn't even think about maybe owning the character or what it would become after that.
Yeah. Setting this back and like doing that research back into the comic book industry from earlier on, you've worked in so many aspects of the comic book industry. What made you want to dig back, and then how did you do that research?
Yeah, Secret Identity was much more intensive, like much more journalistic. I actually interviewed different creators like Jerry Conway and Louis Simonson and Linda Feit, who wrote The Cat, which was the first new series with a female writer. Just to get a sense of what it was like to be a woman in comics or working in comics. The research for Alter Ego was different since it was really like a lived-in experience. I'd been there, I've been on panels, I've seen kind of the underbelly of Comic-Con and things like that. So it was more talking to other creators about what they worry about. What do you think about when you take on a work-for-hire gig or when you launch something on your own? Like, what are the things you look for in a contract? Like, what's the worst meeting you've ever had? Or what are some of the bad dealings you've had? But one thing I didn't want to lose the wonder of it all, you know, like I think when you read Alter Ego, you see, oh, this could go badly, but you'd never lose that sense of it's pretty cool that you're working in comics. You know, there's so that sense of like, wow, this is neat. I didn't want to disappear. So that was the balancing act.
Well, what about the Lynx stuff and the callbacks to, like you said, both the graphic novel and the previous novel? How do you make sure you're not oversaturating with Easter eggs and references?
Yeah, I didn't want it to feel like homework. I didn't want anyone to feel like they were reading Alter Ego and then, oh man, I have to really go read this comic book just to understand what happened. So all the nods are light. You know, each of these pieces stands on their own. But yes, if you read Secret Identity, then the Legendary Lynx trade that Mad Cave just put out, where we remastered the series and reprinted the first four issues, wink, wink, and Alter Ego, you're going to get something more. You're going to get the cool little Easter eggs. But I mean, that's why they say kill your darlings. Like, sometimes the quickest things to get you where you need to go is to cut out the pieces that are just, like, decorations.
I do want to get back to something you said earlier about the underbelly of Comic-Con. Tell us about that.
Yeah, give us the underbelly. We've seen a lot of the belly, but you've not seen the underbelly. You've lived
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, like, I think people are fascinated by the idea that this magical medium that's built on colorful superheroes and characters and sound effects and just pops out has this very kind of mundane side to it, like contracts or meetings or, you know, green rooms at tiny conventions in the far corners of the world. Like, it's a job, and I like showing the nuts and bolts of that. And I think that's what mystery readers really enjoy when you take them somewhere else that maybe they're not super familiar with. This author, Megan Abbott, she writes noir novels in any kind of setting. She's written one in the cheerleading world, high school cheerleading, science, like two scientists, and she can weave in the elements of a great thriller. So I really took that to heart. I was like, if there was a murder mystery in comics, what would it be over? And it would probably be over a character. Like, you stole my idea. That's like, what greater motivation is there than that to kill someone?
And the thing I'm always amazed about when I'm at a con is how so much of comics is still a person-to-person industry, where it's like, I'm going to talk to this person. It's important that I'm here at this time. It's such a, as everything moves to Zoom and all of that, I feel like comics is almost getting more of that interpersonal, where you might have, it's easier to have a murder when you, the person you're trying to kill is right in front of you.
Yeah, and it's good to have that FaceTime. I think comics is very much still about, you know, people you know and the connections you have and those relationships and how you maintain them. So yeah, there is ample opportunity to kill someone.
Now, this is coming out on the 3rd, and I only have vague knowledge of this, but I saw there's an audiobook as well that they teased. I'm blanking on the word. I should have written it down, but they were talking about how, like, it's an immersive audio experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about that?
Okay, so my one big point of panic with Secret Identity was, like, how the hell are they going to make an audiobook when there's a novel, which, yes, you can make an audiobook out of a novel, but in Secret Identity and in Alter Ego, there are comic book pages that Sandy Gerrell has masterfully drawn and Jack Morelli lettered, and he really evokes the style of the 70s of Secret Identity. Sorry, there's a motorcycle. And then he picks up the modern day and changes the style because it's a different artist, but... my worry was, like, how are you going to do audio on a comic book? And I was really blown away by what the Secret Identity narrator, Ida Relusco, and what Frankie, the narrator of Alter Ego, did, because they make it sound like a movie. You know, they use effects, they change their voices, they put, you know, different sounds in there. I'm sure I'm using all the wrong terminology because I'm not.
I feel like sounds is probably.
Yeah, sounds is good. That's what they are.
Sounds and, like, effects. But
this is sounds.
It's not just somebody reading the book, which is part of the prose sections. But when they get into the comic book sequences, Frankie does an amazing job of adding elements and different narrational tools to make it feel like you're, like, you know, the Star Wars audiobooks do that really well too. They make it feel like an immersive experience. And so it makes it clear that there's a big gear shift happening and you're listening to something else.
Yeah, that sound design makes all the difference. And I agree with you. What I think you're saying is, like, it is the translation you need for an audio medium to have that sort of dip into a multimedia universe there.
Yeah, as I build out the LEU.
Now, if you don't mind, you have a lot of irons in the fire right now.
Yes, so let's hear these irons.
About a couple of other things that you're working on. To stay on the novel bent, I was pretty excited to see you writing a book called, or wrote a book, maybe you're done, I don't know, Enemy of My Enemy, which is a daredevil crime novel. How do you tackle something like that?
I mean, it's kind of wild, but Daredevil's probably one of my favorite Marvel heroes, just the perfect example of, like, messy protagonist. Like, he tries really hard to do the right thing, and he just kind of stumbles along the way, and he means well, but and there's been so many epic runs on the character. Like, I don't think he's had really a bad go of it for more than an issue or two. And that was something where Marvel and Disney and Hyperion reached out, and obviously they knew me from my crime novels, but I've also done some work for them with the Spider-Verse novel and a Poe Dameron novel. And so they knew I could handle, like, a work for hire novel. But I think the challenge became, like, where does this fit? Like, you know, where do I weave this story? And I was actually talking to Bendis. I saw him at Book Fair, and I mentioned to him that the novel kind of happens in his run, like, right before the big identity reveal. But obviously that's not canonical, but that's really was the big question I had to answer for myself. Like, where does this fit? Like, is it a Brubaker era story, or is it like during Frank Miller times? But I wanted, you know, I wanted to be able to use all the stuff that these guys did without overburdening the reader and making them feel like they have to read 1,000 issues of Daredevil to understand. Right. And so the challenge is like, how do you make it appealing to a new reader, but also the people that are going to buy it are probably going to be big Daredevil fans and people that are coming from the show or from the comics. And the idea is that basically one of Daredevil's main enemies has been murdered. And while this feels okay to Daredevil because the person's no longer a problem, he realizes he has to defend the murder suspect. And that's none other than Frank Castle. So he's got a...
Were you able to incorporate how great Matt Murdock is at making love?
yes, there's interstitial sequences throughout the novel.
Oh, great! Really standalone. Yeah. Really highlighting it.
Yeah.
Slightly.
That's
more
continuity. That's not me. That's continuity.
Slightly more seriously, though. One. So, I mean, I could wrap my brain around, like, generally how a Daredevil novel would work, because there is so heavy on narration generally with the comics. But one very specific visual aspect of Daredevil's powers is his radar sense. How did you tackle writing that in the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging because you, I can't say, you know, Daredevil saw that this was in there. Obviously, he's limited. He's blind, but he's got this additional sense that expands his other senses. So I found that the clearest path was to get into hyper detail about what he's feeling with his senses and then describe the radar sense as literal sonar. Like, he can make out shapes and details, but he can't see, like, if you show him a page, he can't see what's on the page. He can just make out the shape of the page. I reread basically every Daredevil issue. I started from the beginning and I read everything all the way up to the current run, Saladin and Aaron Cooter stuff. And, you know, everyone does it differently. I think the way Anne Nesenti does it is really interesting. She's very descriptive. Some writers don't lean into it that much. They just show, they're much more action driven, but for a novel, you're in his head most of the time. So you have to kind of experience his senses the way Matt Murdock does. And so that was an interesting challenge. And it's something I had to be mindful of writing every scene, basically.
Yeah.
Long story short, it was difficult.
Keeping your thesaurus there, checking synonyms for descriptions, etc. You had mentioned Star Wars earlier, and you're also doing a big Star Wars project for Marvel called The Battle of Jakku, which is, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
It's
three linked four-issue miniseries that sort of bridge the gap between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens. Again, like, talk about tackling that, particularly because you've got essentially three series that you're doing that are telling this overarching story over a very broad period of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge responsibility because I think it's a period of time that Star Wars fans, and who isn't a Star Wars fan at this point, like, everyone is aware of the mythos. That's where the big questions are. Like, what were Luke, Leia, and Han doing after Return of the Jedi before we got into where we see them again on the timeline? You know, you see Luke in Mandalorian, and obviously you see them in the new trilogy, but what have they been up to, and how did things get there? It's a little bit of a tighter stretch because it leads you up and you go into the Battle of Jakku. That's really the culmination of the series. But it's still a lot of fertile territory. So I wanted it to feel like another movie. Like, if there was another movie after Return of the Jedi, what would that look like? And I don't mean that in a, like, egotistical way, like, I'm going to write the next Star Wars movie, but it was like, it has to feel big. All the key players have to be there. You know, there has to be a villain that's threatening enough that it feels like, oh, this is going to be a challenge that is going to really pose a threat to our heroes. And I think so far the response has been really good. I think people are happy that does have that epic scope, and so I just hope we stick the landing. But I'm, you know, with artists like Leonard Kirk and Stefano Raphael and Jethro Morales, I think it'll look great.
We really sparked in the first couple of issues to the idea of the Imperials not leaving, like, not leaving it behind, just sort of staying, like, no, we're gonna stay the course, we're gonna keep going. Talk about framing them up as the villains there, what you were pulling on, what the emotional thrust was, etc.
Yeah, I was fascinated by this idea that, you know, I think sometimes people assume, okay, Return of the Jedi, you destroyed the Death Star, we're good to go. Like, now the New Republic starts and everything's clean and smooth. Like, no war ends like that. War is messy, it's dirty, it's a lot of gray areas. So obviously there's going to be some Imperials that just refuse to follow what they feel is a false narrative. And so a lot of the story is about Adelhard, who is this Imperial who's literally sealed off the Anuit sector and said, this is going to continue to be the Empire and you can't take it away from me. And then how does this new Republic, which is still getting its sea legs and trying to figure out how to govern and how to be, like, now you have to pivot and deal with this other threat, just as the rest of the Empire, or what's left of the Empire, is collecting somewhere. And obviously we know it's Jakku, but they don't know it. And so it's like these two sides of the war that they weren't ready to fight. I find that stuff, the geopolitical stuff, is really fascinating and interesting to play out, because there's so many characters in that lore that I can could pull from and really play. And there was other established stuff that happened, like Chuck Wendig's Aftermath novels, a lot of the stuff Alexander Freed did, The Princess and the Scoundrel, all canonical stuff. So I wanted to honor what was already there, but still make sure that this felt like a big thing that is affecting what people might know about Jakku. Like, the part you know still happened. Like, I'm not changing what happened. I'm adding another layer of texture that is going to change how you perceive those things when you experience them again.
How does it feel working? I feel like you work a lot in universes that there are so many factors to consider as you're trying to be creative. Like, are you sort of doing the research, putting those guardrails up, and then cutting loose? Or are you like just putting a bunch of ideas out there and then trying to figure out how to pinpoint all of them within the context of what's come before?
It's a little of both. Like, the good thing is, you know, we go back and forth with, I have great editors, Mark, Drew, and Mikey at Marvel, and obviously Lucasfilm, and Mike Siglain at Disney, and it's a lot of bouncing ideas back and forth, but it's more the latter. I think about the big story, how it would be compelling, and then try to find the pieces that could fit into that, as long as they don't negate other stuff. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and then you go back to the drawing board. But I think the story is what should spring everything into place. You know, it's got to feel epic and important. And that's a challenge, because it's such a rich timeline. You know, there's so much stuff going on at so many places, and not every threat can be a universe shattering threat, you know, but I think we tried to make it work this time.
We got a question here from the comments. Thomas Dar says, in all seriousness, I'm curious if current politics influenced Alex's take on Star Wars books.
I mean, I think we're always influenced by what's going on in the world around us. I don't want to say one for one, this is a commentary. It's just really like we're writing is an exercise in your subconscious as much as it is like literal story. So I'm sure whatever I'm thinking about or experiencing in my mind and heart are coming out on the page in some way.
Yeah. This is from Nat Townsend. Can you ask him about Dick Tracy if you have the time? What about it?
Yes,
we do.
The first trade is about to come out next month, and that collects issue 1 through 5, and we're about to launch the second arc. So it's still the same team, me, Mike Moraci writing, and Geraldo Borges on art. It's going to be a much more intimate story, but no less terrifying. You know, the first arc was a big gang war epic, and this next arc is a little bit more Silence of the Lambs / Manhunter serial killer vibes, but it also brings in one of the key rogues that we have not seen yet. So that'll be fun.
Oh, we got a follow-up here at our press conference with Nat Townsend. How did he end up with the license? I'm curious how that came together.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, we thought we had it when I was at Archie years ago, and we even announced the Dick Tracy comic, which was going to be co-written by Moraci and I at the time. And then we realized in conversations with Tribune that we did not have it. There was a mistake. And I thought that was it. Yeah, it was a huge bummer.
Because I
love the character, clearly. So I was super psyched to be doing it. And then after the dust settled and some time passed and I wasn't at Archie anymore, we reached out to them and said, can we get the license ourselves, like the creators? And they knew me, so it was not like we were unknowns, and I'd obviously been on the other side of publishing before. I wasn't just a random person asking for the rights to this iconic hero. And so we were able to get the license, and then we talked to Mad Cave, and they were immediately excited. And once Geraldo came on board, it really locked in. But that's the broad strokes of it. Nat, my press corps.
There is one other book that I wanted to ask you about, though. The question, All Along the Watchtower, came out from DC. Great book, and I think this is maybe what Justin was alluding to a little bit with his question, because question about the question, because there are so many different things that you need to deal with getting into that book. Not only the new status of DC, the Justice League Watchtower and everything that's going on there. You got a murder mystery you're setting up. You got Renee Montoya's new status quo. So entering that book in particular, to sort of extend off of what Justin's saying, I'm sure, you know, the question seems like a no-brainer for you because it's like, hey, it's a noir character. You write noir. There you go. But this is so much more than that, and I was really impressed how balanced it was in that first issue.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think one of the challenges we face now as writers of comics, mainstream comics, is that you don't have that endless runway that maybe existed 10, 15 years ago where, okay, I'm on an ongoing, you know, I'll explain little bits and pieces, and by issue 12, you'll have an understanding of the bigger macro story. Now it's really your first issue has to kind of knock it out of the park, and then you kind of hope that momentum carries over to the rest of the arc. But there were a lot of things going on. Thankfully, I'd had some time with Renee before I got to write a three-part Batman Brave and the Bold story, and I did a short Lazarus Planet story, so I didn't have to do that kind of shakedown cruise of learning how to write her. Like, I had a feeling that I knew her voice. But I also didn't want to feel like it was super exposition heavy, where it's just like her sidekick is just narrating everything that's going on. So I tried to weave it all together through flashback and also a lot of West Wing walk and talk is happening in that issue with Wonder Woman. And I wanted Renee to feel kind of off balance. So the reader feels off balance because you're not really sure what's going to happen. And it's the first day on the job. Like, what's more relatable than that? But it was a challenge, but I think what we tried to do and what Kian Torme did fantastically with his art is give these moments that are a little expository, a sense of action and momentum, like we're moving towards something.
Well, and let me just, when we talked about it, I was like, the technical prowess that you showcased, putting all that detail together while still giving us some emotional drive there, because Renee Montoya, complicated, like a lot of moves in her character backstory. But I will say, to compliment the art as well, like we got to see the epic scale of the Watchtower in the backdrop. So even those expositional moments still had like some like, oh shit, this is a lot of stuff is going to happen here. It felt like we were putting a pin in something that was going to be really exciting, no matter how much we had to learn to get to
the
story.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do was, it's really a love letter to the DC universe. Like the characters that are used, the characters that walk on or cameo. Like, you get a sense of the bigger, wider universe, but you're watching through the eyes of a very grounded superhero. Like, has no superpowers. She can put the mask on. That's like her power.
And she's like, all these other heroes, I'm not impressed by these people anymore. They're losers, scumbags.
But, I was happy that I got to use the heroes I got to use, because it is a very kind of bizarre group. But it also, they have this unifying idea where they're trying to really like make it this time. Like, they're trying to really like cement themselves as worthy of being on the Justice League. And, you know, when stuff gets turned upside down, they have no choice. They have to step up. So that's where the story is going.
Without spoiling too much, the end of the first issue ends in a murder. I won't say who necessarily is killed. Given that it is a murder mystery, the way that it's set up, do we have all the clues, or at least the suspects, in front of us?
Oh, look at you.
Wow, Alex, get out of here.
All right,
no, I have some detectives. I can throw some guesses.
Last panel
out.
From issue 6 is going to be... No, look, I'm a firm believer in like the earned mystery, meaning that if you're reading the mystery and you can figure it out on your own, you need to have enough on the page to get you there. Like, the worst would be if someone gets to the end and they're like, oh, it's the butler or the person that showed up in panel 2 and never again was the killer. It's you don't want to short circuit that relationship with the reader. You want to build that trust. So yeah, everything's going to be spelled out. If you figure it out early, then you're very smart. If you don't figure it out, you'll at least realize that the stuff was there.
You're very dumb. Got it.
Yeah, all right. Don't read
anymore. Wait, real quick. Is it Ted Kord? Did Ted Kord do it?
Alex,
just tell me. Tell me.
Come on.
Oh, God. Drive me crazy. Oh, it was me? Yeah. Oh, that's a big twist.
That does sound like something to you.
I always feel that the reader is the most important part of the book, so I get it.
Nice. The reader did it.
Yeah, Alex grilling Alex. I don't know.
Yeah, this Alex on Alex violence. That's
let's get back to alter ego though, to sort of bring it back around. Obviously, you now have three things in the, what do we call it, LEU.
Is we also have the links.
Yes. Yeah. Are there plans for a fourth? Are you going to do another sidequel or a direct sequel? Or is it too early to say at this point since the book isn't even out yet?
Extending the universe.
Yeah, no, it's not too early to say. One thing I do in Alter Ego and Secret Identity is kind of hint at the greater universe of characters. Like, you know, if you know me and you know my creator-owned output and you read the books that Triumph Comics publish, it's stuff like The Dusk, The Black Ghost, The Awaken, books that exist actually. But I have no big plans to keep it going. I feel really proud of this little triptych of stuff, like these two novels and this graphic novel. And it feels complete, like now that I've done the modern day response to Secret Identity. But I've learned over time to never say never to stuff like this. And maybe a story will arrive and in my mind and I'll have to tell it. But my next crime novel after Daredevil is going to be a little bit more of a big mob thriller kind of thing. I'm calling it like The Godfather Meets Parallax View. Wow. With a female reporter as the protagonist in the present day. So, but lots of like jumping back and forth in time.
Awesome. Alex, this is great. We love all the stuff that's coming out from you. Congratulations on everything.
I'm so glad to chat with you.
Yeah, so good always to see you as always.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too. My best to you and yours. Thankful for you guys.
Oh, thankful for you. Alex. Have a good night.
More you know.
Have a good night, Alex.
Later.
All right, there we go. Once again, the book is called Alter Ego. It is coming out December 3rd from Flatiron Books. Check it out. And you can also check out the immersive audiobook if you prefer.
I love it.
Basically, just go to a comic book shop because Alex writes everything. So eventually you're going to find his stuff.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And we are going to move on to our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It is your audience questions. And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, maybe Instagram. I'll take a looky-loo over there. But first, we got a cocktail this week to celebrate season.
Yeah.
From our friend Brett Macris. Getting choked up here just even thinking
Stray
about
bullies.
It. Stray Bullet. It is the A Thankful Cocktail. It's bourbon rye, maple syrup, orange juice, cinnamon, orange bitters, and orange peel. Justin, did you make one of those?
Or? I did, and I'll tell you what. This is one, like, orange juice bourbon, I was, let me be honest, suspect. And I didn't even have orange juice, so I used grapefruit juice. And it was, I threw a cinnamon stick in there. It was excellent. Very good cocktail. Very autumnal. Very seasonal. Shouts to Stray Bullet.
Yeah. Awesome.
Straight at
sounds great. And Pete, you're having a garage even though you don't have a garage? Is that...
Oh my God, you're psychic.
Excellent. Great. Ooh, we got a great question here to kick things off from Stanley. The first guest, Diana, was very fun, especially Pete's reactions. Any comic topics that make Alex or Justin uncomfortable?
Oh, yeah.
That's a
Thank
great question.
You, Stanley.
Great question.
Good looking out.
I will say, maybe it might be actually helpful to answer for each other a little bit here as well. I will say, for Alex, was it Secret Wars Zero? What was the comic that had you flip your absolute lid?
Yeah, that was Secret Wars Zero. I got very mad about. I still feel bad about that, but...
that was a pure reaction, much like Pete's reaction to superhero sex. I think your reaction was pure, so like... Hard to feel shame.
I don't know.
I am unflappable. So
yeah, we all know that. Yeah, you're bulletproof.
Nothing is off. Yeah. Bring it on. I'm in. Even when Alex was buying porno comics with me, I was still into it.
Yes, this is very exciting. I just alphabetized my graphic novels the other weekend, so they're all in order, and I got to Small Favors, and I thought of you.
I mean, truly, one of my, we've told the story maybe before, but maybe again, I'm thankful for this moment in my life. We went to, is it Colleen Coover?
Yeah, it was Colleen Coover's table the last day of San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes, and this is like 10 plus years ago. Colleen Coover's book, it is a very sexual book. And Alex is like, oh, I want one of those. And she goes, this one? And Alex goes, uh-huh. In the most, like, ain't I a stinker voice I've ever heard. It was a treasured memory. Treasured.
Ah, good times. Schreckler says, what are your favorite and least favorite resolutions to mysteries?
Ooh.
Mm. I was thinking of this while we were talking to Alex, because I was thinking of, what was it where that wasn't Infinite Crisis, where the murder, and it was like, who killed?
Identity Crisis.
Identity Crisis.
Yeah.
That was one of my least favorite, I feel like.
Yes. Well, it's sort of, I'd have to reread it. I don't think we're spoiling anything. Fair. This came out years ago, but I really was, to Alex's point, felt like it came out of nowhere, where it was suddenly Jean Loring had murdered her by shrinking down and stepping on her brain and giving her an aneurysm, I believe.
Yeah.
It's like, what are we doing here? This is...
It was an unfortunate, it was all bad. It was such a bummer. And it came out of nowhere, contradicting what we were just talking about mysteries. Yeah. The death of Dr. Light, right?
No, that was the death of Sue Dibney.
Oh, Sue Dibney, right.
Sue Dibney died. That also, and the thing that was extra disappointing about that, not to talk about Identity Crisis too much, but it also had some great issues at the beginning.
Yes. The first, I want to say three, I thought were really good and exciting.
Particularly, I think about the Deathstroke issue all the time, the one where he just systematically takes down the Justice League one by one. Amazing.
You think about that all the time?
I do. Whatever.
Like when you walk into a new room, you're like, oh, I could systematically take down everyone in this room.
No, but Deathstroke could.
But you guys love Deathstroke. We have to have a longer conversation about your Deathstroke love. Deathstroke to me is like boring.
What?
I stroke for Deathstroke, man. I stroke for Deathstroke.
Wow, nice. Great. Put it on
your weird. That doesn't make me uncomfortable. I just said it. All the Game says, hey, were you Wicked or Gladiator 2 this weekend or both? I was neither. What about you guys?
I was neither of those. I am going to see Wicked over the Thanksgiving break. I did see. Nice. I saw Anora, and I saw a screening of Nosferatu today.
Ooh,
which is sick AF.
I'm looking forward to the Weekend Geek exciting. Talking more about that.
Mm. Kyle Jones has a question for me. I saw Alex's question on Tom Brevoort's newsletter. Were you satisfied with his answer?
What's happening?
So Tom Brevoort has a weekly newsletter. It's great. Everybody should subscribe.
Yeah, you plug it a lot.
It's really good. Like,
he's involved now.
Yes, I'm involved now. Well, one of the things that he does that I think makes it really good, I don't know how he has the time, but he has an open forum for questions that he answers. People leave them in the comments on his newsletter that he answers in the next week. So I'm trying to remember. What did I write in? Oh, I asked him about starting a comic book title during an event, like his take on it, specifically because it came off of, like, they'd announced a bunch of titles were kicking off in One World Under Doom. Red Hulk, there's Weapon X-Men, there's a Thunderbolts title, plus all the tie-ins and everything. And I think, like we talked about on the stack in particular a lot, I always feel like it sort of stimmies a book a little bit when you launch it during an event, because you don't... I was specifically thinking about, like, Spider-Woman, which launched during the Gang War event, where a lot of our conversations were like, she's in Gang War, then she's jumping over here and doing this thing with her son, and then she's back in Gang War, and it's just, it's like too much, it's too fractured, it feels like something you have to get past. So I was curious to get his take on it, and he gave a very abbreviated answer, being like, well, Weapon X-Men, we... originally had a pitch where they were going to go to Latveria, so it made sense to put it in the event. And I was like, all right, that's fine. You're busy. I'm not going to begrudge you not answering for too long, but I don't think he specifically answered the overarching question. He answered one specific instance of it.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you. It is hard when that character has to be woven into the story and is doing stuff in the event and then in their personal lives, especially a character like Spider-Woman, to use your gang war example, that we already like and we've sort of ridden with for quite some time. But I would go back and call out Zero Hour, which launched a lot of great books, including Starman, one of my faves. That was just a great launch pad because it was, it felt like it wasn't about the character having to do stuff. It was about putting a character in a place and getting new readers into that. Primal Force Zero came out of that, another book that I liked that was weird and fun. And I do think it does work as long as it's not like too complicated of a launch.
Yeah, I guess, so to use the example of the Red Hulk title, and obviously I have not read it, so I don't know how it's going to pan out, but Thunderbolt Ross ends up in Latveria and is like, well, I don't like the fact that Dr. Doom has taken over the world, so I'm going to start fighting him. This doesn't actually matter to me as a reader necessarily if I'm enjoying the story, but I immediately think, okay, so that first arc, he's fighting Doom in Latveria, and then the One World Under Doom thing ends, and then what is the title after that? Like, what is your pitch for the book is my question here, divorced from this event that's happening right now.
That's a great call, especially when, at least what we've learned about Doom from, say, the Spider-Man book that we saw a couple weeks ago or last week, was that he's like basically all powerful and offloading tasks to other people. So it's Red Hulk's going to go punch him a bunch. Okay. I don't know quite see how this matches.
And it's just, it seems tied to the event. And I understand using it as a launch pad because it makes it a broader, like, well, I got to buy all of the issues in One World Under Doom. So I'm also going to get this one. And if you like it, you'll hopefully continue reading it. So I understand the strategy there, but I don't know. That was a long answer, Kyle. I guess to be clear, I'm very thankful per the theme of our show, that Tom Brevoort does take the time to answer this. I don't know 100% he asked me to answer the question to my satisfaction, but also I'm not going to ask it again.
That's nice. No. I will quote Nat Towson and say, bad answer to your question.
I'm being very nice. I'm being
politic. Shouts, you're involved.
All in the Game says Moana 2 was very lukewarm reviews so far. Surely No Way the Rock has two underperforming movies just 2 weeks apart. We're, of course, talking about Red 1 and now Moana 2. Moana 2 is expected to be the biggest debut of the year, so it doesn't matter. The quality doesn't matter.
I would say that movie will perform well, despite, based on my observation of the trailer, it not being as good. And just to give a little context on the development of Moana 2, Moana 2 was meant to be a TV series that when Bob Iger, the head of Disney, came in, was like, what are you doing, a TV show? No, make that a movie. We want to make money. And so they transformed a TV plot into a movie. So not a great pedigree, I would argue.
Yes. Nat Towson says, what is cool about Deathstroke?
Yes, let's go. What are you going to say? His boots? His little turnover boots that you love?
Where you went first?
Gaston boots? Because my answer is nothing's cool about Deathstroke. He looks like Gaston
from
Beauty and the
Beast.
Hard
disagree. One, he's a badass. Two, cool mask. All right.
Cool mask. Have you ever heard of Deadpool? Same thing.
Yeah. Well, it still works.
Deadpool was based on Deathstroke.
But does it make me like him more?
Yes, except for Rob Liefeld says that he wasn't, but he was. So, yeah. Not to specifically go back to that issue I called out before, but he is a planner. Like, I know he has. I like a villain who, like, that comes through.
He loves a plan. He loves it when a plan comes together. He likes plans.
Spreadsheets. Go bag.
The idea of that book, the way that Brad Meltzer wrote it, was that he's like, on my own, I have enhanced strength. I have healing. I have training. But I'm probably not going to be able to take down Wonder Woman just by going one-on-one. So I need to be ahead of her. He's basically like Dark Batman with a sword at his best when he's written like that. And I think that's how it plays out. Pretty much since the new Teen Titans thing, the Marv Wolfman, George Perez, I think was on art for that arc, is he's all about like being 100% prepared, so he is five steps ahead of everybody at all times. That's
makes
cool.
sense. He that only makes has a good his sword.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
So he's cool. like Nothing he's like Black swords, Knight. Too. He's like Black cool. Knight from Marvel, but like also worse.
Wow, Nat has a lot of questions tonight. Both Heavy Metal and Metal Hurlant launched 5K Kickstarters that raised over $200,000. Is this an underserved part of the market, or do you think it's just nostalgia? Who's better and who should win?
Wow.
Oh, boy.
That's a hot...
I don't think this is an underserved part of the market. I do think it's in part... for anybody who doesn't know, these are both classic sci-fi, horror, fantasy, magazine-style... like a little more extreme content, comic books and sometimes articles and other things. They both, like Nat says, have come back on Kickstarter and have done really well. And I think like, I think it's a combination of things. I don't think people are like, I want hardcore comic book magazines, because I would challenge you to just like put that out into a comic book store and people be like, cool, I'm going to pick this up. That's not going to happen. It will happen for some people, but I don't think it's going to be insanely popular. I think it's the combination of creators that they have here, these things coming back in a big way and making a big splash. Kickstarter certainly supporting them. I think they were both projects we love, so they get a big boost from that. And yeah. they're offering like really good prestige format books. So if you are already interested in that sort of thing, you're going to get excited about this. And in terms of who should win, neither.
Both. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Safe take. I think it is nostalgia. Not that that's necessarily a negative. Like, these are books that you could open and be like, what is this? If you were like just a new to comics and you picked up a Heavy Metal, it was like, wow, this is wild and intense. And I think it left a mark on people. So I think that's why it's coming back. Who should win? I think Heavy Metal.
Yeah, I mean, metal is an underserved, you know, I disagree with you, Alex. I think people love metal, you know, they don't get enough metal, you know, so it's nice to have some metal outlets, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a good answer here and a great place to finish up our audience questions. Michael T. says Deathstroke should win.
There we go.
That's really
Thank you,
nice.
Michael T. Yeah.
He planned his Kickstarter five moves before both of them. Yeah. That's how he rolls.
I came in the room.
Thank you all for your audience questions. We're going to move on with our next section, which is trivia. And for that, we're going to turn it over to Pete LePage.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. Ooh. It's an opportunity to win $25 free to Midtown Comics Online.
Twitch is hopping. Look at this.
I told you, Twitch is where it's at, man. Love me some Twitch. So, so if you had $25, you'd want to go to a comic book shop. You know, get yourself some comics.
Oh, boy. Zenman says, hand up. Hartford says, me. And Zenman says, oh, give it to Hartford.
Zenman sharing the gauntlet. That's very nice.
Oh, I guess we'll go with Hartford then.
All right. There we go.
All right.
Hartford,
here we go.
Shouts to Connecticut.
Today's trivia is about the impressive comic book series Jonah Hex and a small nod to the legend Terry Garr, R.I.P. Inga. All right. Wow. Please listen to all three options before making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. What amazing artist jumped in on issue 50 for an unbelievably great run? Was it A, Darwin Cook? B, hey, congrats on getting a cat. What's its name? C, Peter Gatto.
Wow, I love the multilingual nature here.
Ooh, is it A?
You A is A. correct.
Yeah. I will say, Twitch people are on it. There's no delay.
No delay, which is nice. I'm telling you, the Twitch is where it's at. Question number two, what is a notable alias for Jonah Hex? Is it A, the mark of a demon? B, dude, don't make your thing brighter. C, Dick Whitening.
I mean, if that's a real name, shouts to that person.
Does that work? Does that work?
Yeah.
B. Oh, is man. B?
No. It's no. A. It's A, of course.
All right. Well, that's one of two, so.
Yeah. If you get still going. Three, yeah. If you get two out of three, you still win. Yeah. What year did Jonah Hex make his first full story appearance? Is it A, 1972? B, Steve, who stole your cake from the work fridge? C, Mary Dunnett.
Whoa, A?
Wow, coming
A is
out
correct.
Swinging. That's
wow,
nice.
Wow, congratulations.
Really great.
Hartford, the entire city of Hartford, 1988.
Yeah, shout outs to Hartford.
Connecticut.
What a city. Favorites.
The CT, that's where your peeps be.
What?
What?
What are you quoting, if anything?
Anyway, Hartford, you have won a $25 gift card to Midtown Comics. Shoot us an email, and we will get that off to you. Pete, what movie were you referencing with your third answers?
Surely the Jonah Hex movie, an iconic movie that we all saw in theaters.
Nope.
Yes, we did.
We all did, but not good movie.
Whalers all day, yes, Hartford.
I'm talking about the 1982 classic Tootsie.
Tootsie's a great movie. Michael T has a question, Pete. Explain answer C to question two.
Okay. Let's see what...
That was Dick Whitening, I believe.
Yeah. Richard Whitening. I took some liberties and said Dick Whitening, but his real name
is
Richard.
B. Read B and then C. That's what he's wondering about.
What?
Read the B answer.
Okay. Dude, don't make your thing brighter. C, Dick Whitening.
Wow, Pete, you don't like re-examining your trivia? This is your work. We're looking at it. We're looking at what's on the page.
I don't have a problem with somebody else, but you guys giving me shit is, you know, where I have.
We're not giving you shit. We're investigating.
We're asking you questions.
Yeah. What are we all but trivia all day? You know?
Well, anyway, as we all know, new comic books come out tomorrow. We're very excited for them, except many are not. Just a heads up. Due to a diamond shipping error, a lot of them are not going to be in stores. I believe they should still be available digitally. But if you don't see a book that is on stands tomorrow, it should be hitting on December 4th. That all said, what are you guys looking forward to that's coming out sometime?
A lot of great stuff coming out. Can't wait to talk to you guys about it. I'm looking forward to Absolute Wonder Woman number 2. Black Canary, Best of the Best number 1. And then Red Before Black number 3.
Good. Interesting choices.
Justin, what about you?
Well, there is a lot of stuff coming out. I'm going to give it up to the conclusion to Universal Monsters Frankenstein.
Oh, yes, dude.
The fourth issue of that is coming out. Very excited to see how that wraps up. And I got to shout out The Flash number 15 as well. Simon Spurrier has been just running one of the best Flash runs in so long. And despite the fact that the first storyline wrapped, it's continuing, and it's continuing in an exciting way. Keeping it weird, but keeping it fun. Very excited to see where that's going.
Couple of things to throw out there. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 4. Chris Burnham is back on art for that, and it's focusing on Donatello, and that title is good, so very excited. Also, The Serpent in the Garden, Ed Gray and the Last Battle for England. Ooh. That's Mike Mignola and Ben Stenback coming back to the BPRD world after it was destroyed, and that's always a good weird time. And the last one I'll give a shout out to is Welcome to the Maynard number 1. We had James Robinson and J-Bone on the show a couple of weeks ago, and we talked to them about this book, so you can go listen to it.
That's also where James Robinson sort of announced he was doing more Starman, so let's just hold on to that.
I was hilarious because I thought you said James Robinson, and then you said your nickname for him. You were like, you know, J-Bone. I was like, what? You call Jay Robinson J-Bone?
All the time, man.
J-Bone squared on that
book. Me and J-Bone down by the schoolyard.
Real quick, though, on Mike Mignola, I just flexed about this, but I did see Nosferatu, and that is the most Mike Mignola on screen you will ever see.
It is not flexing all
pure,
over.
Pure Mike Mignola on screen. Definitely go see that when that comes out.
Excited.
Robert Eggers movie.
Other than Nosferatu, all of those things are going to be in our Stack podcast that comes out Wednesday, 9 a.m., both of the Comic Book Club feed and its dedicated Stack feed. And folks, that is it for this week's show. Woo-hoo. A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Alex Segura for coming on for talking about Alter Ego that is out December 3rd from Flatiron Books. Also, Diana McCallum, you can check out The Sex Lives of Superheroes out now from Smart Pop. Next week on the show, we're going to have Jeff Johns and Ivan Rice are going to be here to talk about Hyde Street, And all the spooky horror stuff that they're doing there. So that should be fun. Comic Book Club News, our daily news show. Check that out Monday through Friday. Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast. We finished up talking about Agatha a little while back. Sons of a Gun, finished up talking about Penguin. So you can check out all of that. Patreon.com/comicbookclub to support the show and all the shows we do. You can subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on Instagram and TikTok, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Good night, folks.
Monster!
So grab your windhammer and don't be late for it, 'cause their girlfriends can barely tolerate it. Comic Book Club, Comic Book Club, Comic Book Club, Comic Book
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.